Chapter 7, The Tribal Leadership Epiphany. In the years when Richard Nixon was president, Bob Tobias was living the wild world of Stage 3 and loving it. Then a reporter asked him a simple question that led to a cascade of insights that we term the epiphany. After this process, he emerged as a tribal leader. Tobias came to Washington in 1966 to go to law school, and he never left. While working at the Internal Revenue Service, he learned how labor unions worked, and that became his passion for the next 30 years. He went to work for what is now the National Treasury Employees Union, NTEU, and became general counsel in 1970. In a Stage 3 moment of glory, he filed a lawsuit against Richard Nixon for freezing federal employee pay. The suit was dismissed under the case law that a sitting president cannot be sued. Tobias appealed, expecting to lose, and then the famous Nixon tape surfaced. In a separate case in which NTEU collaborated, the United States Supreme Court ruled that no one, not even a sitting president, is above the law, and thus can be sued. With that precedent behind him, Tobias eventually won a $533 million judgment against Richard Nixon on behalf of every federal employee. Tobias told us it was an ego hit of the highest order, and his journey through Stage 3 was just getting started. Today, Tobias is deceptively quiet. He has a small build, bright eyes, and a wide smile, with an appearance that conveys the meticulous nature of an attorney who believes that details matter. We met him on a muggy Saturday in Washington, D.C., when most people were in t-shirts and shorts. Tobias wore a sport coat and never broke a sweat. The image of a soft-spoken, thoughtful man did not match his words. He says, "I told people that the way to make an impact as a union lawyer is to kick the shit out of them so that they never want to see you again." He referred to himself in the 1970s as a badass who would use any management slip as an excuse to arbitrate a grievance, file an unfair labor practice charge, or begin a lawsuit. By 1975, he managed his 13 employees by directly talking with each person, creating dyads as described in the last chapter. When the staff size doubled to 26, Tobias hit the barrier of having only 24 hours in a day, so he appointed regional supervisors in Atlanta, San Francisco, Austin, and Washington. To the frustration of the new managers, he continued to reach out directly to each person. As Tobias told us, they finally confronted me, asking why the hell I had appointed them. Tobias went on, "It was painful for me. I had to give up something I loved, touching each person, but I had no choice." Tobias was working up the management ladder, as many people at Stage 3 do, by turning lessons into new ways to win. From 1970 to 1983, Tobias would fly into a city, arbitrate a grievance or unfair labor practice charge on behalf of one or more union members, usually win, and then leave with the union applause still ringing in his ears. In 1983, the president of the union retired, and Tobias was voted in. Now running one of the most powerful unions in the federal government, he sat at the big desk. On his first day, he took a call from a reporter, and he still remembers the question, "Now that you've been elected, what are you going to do?" Tobias had no idea. He told us, "I knew what I wanted others to not do, mistreat our members, but what was I going to do? That was a slap in the face. I couldn't answer the question." Tobias's epiphany was about to begin. The epiphany in a nutshell. Having interviewed thousands of people who have made it into Stage 4, the zone of tribal leadership, we discovered that every person had an awakening. Some called it a major business insight. One said, "In the shower this morning, I realized that there's a better way to do business that will mean much higher profitability." Some called it corporate karma. Others described it as a need to live their values. Some came to it after years of psychotherapy or doing a self-help program. Some came to it through what Warren Bennis and Robert Thomas, in their books Geeks and Geezers, call a crucible experience, an event that causes people to reflect, at both an intellectual and an emotional level, on their core assumptions. For some people, 9/11 kick-started the epiphany. For most people, the epiphany was actually a series of epiphanies, each presenting a deeper insight about what wasn't working in stage three. While the epiphany happens to all tribal leaders, it may not happen in adulthood. Gordon Binder, the former CEO of Amgen, apparently had it growing up in New Mexico and finished it in the Navy. Mike Ruzioni, the captain of the 1980 United States Olympic hockey team, had something like the epiphany playing hockey early in his life. Frank Jordan, the former mayor of San Francisco, became a tribal leader through the Boys and Girls Clubs. They all described the epiphany as the turning point in their lives, both personally and professionally, regardless of how they came to it or went through it. Although it often took months or years for the epiphany to burble through their minds, once the moment of awareness happened, there was no turning back. They often described it in sound bites. We heard statements like these: "Nothing that matters is personal. Stage three has no legacy. To win at stage three is to win small. I now see I have been a manipulator, not a leader. I'm tired. Isn't there some other game to play? I see myself through others' eyes, and I don't like what I see." Many people became evangelists for the epiphany, but discovered that others weren't swept into the life-changing insights with these taglines. What might be going through your mind is what others said in response. "I know that. That's not a big deal. And so what?" People who've had this epiphany read books differently, often highlighting sections for others, hoping to spread the insights that changed their lives. To them, leadership books that once seemed simple and flat are now richly textured, filled with life-changing words. Books of tips and tools and techniques, once the staple of their reading diet, now strike them as drivel. To people still in stage three, the book of tips is still better, and highlighting sections of a book of platitudes is odd and unhelpful. Our goal in this chapter is for you to be able to lead others through the epiphany the way it happened to many people in our studies. The sequence that Bob Tobias went through is typical, so we'll use that as the backbone of this chapter. Tobias emerged as a stage four tribal leader, having far more success than he could have imagined at stage three. Epiphany Part 1: What have I achieved? The question the reporter asked Tobias sparked reflection and soul-searching, especially about how he had spent his time in the Union up to that point. A memory that was fresh in his mind was a bitter fight in Chicago, where 300 people picketed the IRS in the middle of winter. As the protest got underway, he looked at the temperature on a bank thermometer, and it read minus 15. He sent out for coffee, and by the time he had distributed it, waiting for the press to arrive, a sheet of ice had covered the pot of coffee. That fight seemed to capture his time with the Union, one bitter battle after another. In thinking about the Chicago fight, and many others like it, Tobias says, "It occurred to me that we hadn't done a single thing that would affect how individual supervisors treated people. Not a damn thing. We would go in, win a court victory, and leave. It was an institutional victory, but nothing changed in people's lives." He continues, "I learned to name the thing I was doing that was holding me back. Once I could name it, I could do something about it. It was working for versus working with." He realized that his career had been spent working for the Union members, which required that he work against the government and its managers. Tobias had always seen the first part of that sentence, that he was an advocate, but he had never before realized that his way of operating required an enemy. He assumed the fight, and he created the enemy wherever he went. It's worth noting that both stages 3 and 4 require an adversary. When we work with people in groups, people in stage three groups will say, "I'm great because I sold more last quarter than anyone else," or "I just bought a huge house." They begin to notice that these statements are all comparative, netting out to, "I'm better than others." At stage four, people will say, "We're great because our team is winning," or "We have the best people." Again, this language system implies we're better than them. At stage three, the enemy is other individuals. At stage four, it's another group, or a company, or even an industry. Only at stage five does the need for an enemy go away, as we'll see in a future chapter. There was another part to the epiphany for Tobias, and this was a realization about his own blindness. He said, "I loved winning. I loved being the Lone Ranger. I loved coming into town and slaying the dragon with everyone saying, 'Great job, we needed you.' It was a complete ego hit, and so I couldn't see that I wasn't making an impact." Bingo. The Epiphany, Part 1. Tobias told us, "When I got it, I got it, and then I was relentless." Many people told us in exactly these words, "My impact is far less than I thought. I thought I was winning, but it was all about me. And I didn't do a thing that mattered." Almost as the words are forming in their mouths, they begin to say what the solution is, still in stage three language. "I will find a way to fix this problem, just as I've handled every other problem in my life, with hard work, talent, and guts." Epiphany Part 2. How can I fix this? Tobias began preaching collaboration, working with rather than working for. He learned about interest-based bargaining, working with a professor from the University of Michigan. The more he preached, the more people ignored him. He told us, "I asked my staff why they weren't doing anything differently, and then it became clear, because I wasn't doing anything differently. I was still the Lone Ranger." As Tobias examined his own behavior, he saw that it was similar to what people all around him were doing, including many of the local union presidents. He said, "I realized that they were elected as badasses, and that it would be hard to get them to do anything different." Again and again, in our studies, people going through the epiphany became aware that stage three wasn't working for anyone. In some cases, they see others' shortcomings first. For other people, like Tobias, their own lack of impact came into view first. In every case, they saw that the general system of "I'm great" language and behavior was not achieving success. Although we didn't know Tobias when his epiphany started in 1983, it's likely, in fact almost certain, that he was saying the stage four words, vision, partnership, and collaboration, but that his sentences were focused on "I, me, and my." His recollections in 2006 support what we heard from so many in our study. "I was talking facilitation," he said, "but my approach was still adversarial." Ken Wilber of the Integral Institute told us that people's awareness, which he terms the cognitive line, always comes before feelings or actions. He said, "All developmentalists agree on that." In that case, we're in good company, as our research came to the same conclusion, that people start the move into the epiphany with an awareness of a different way to operate, but without any idea of how to make it real. Since we were measuring their language, not their psychological state, we noticed that people's discussion of stage four came before their actions. Wilber commented, "Awareness comes first, and it has always been this way." Mahatma Gandhi started out with the idea of a free India long before he took the first step to make it free. Jack Welch became aware that the lack of executive collaboration at General Electric was a problem long before he had a strategy to deal with it. If this chapter first hits you as a set of ideas, that's exactly how it should start. The coaching is to let the ideas create an awareness of how things can be different for you and for others. We describe the threshold of stage three and four to former Amgen CEO Gordon Binder. He said, "There's a tremendous irony here. When people operate in the I system, they can't have a legacy. When they operate in the we stage 4 system, they can have an individual legacy. If you told them that, they probably wouldn't believe it." Binder's right, and that's what people at this point in the epiphany realize. The challenge for the coach is to nudge the person to see that the system of stage 3 develops no true followers, hence no legacy. It's not that the person isn't capable of leaving a legacy. She is. It's that the system in which she is operating isn't designed to do that. The first part of the epiphany is that the person isn't making the impact he thought he was. The second part is that the I, me, and my system isn't capable of fixing the problem. The person sees himself as others see him, and they don't like what they see. One of the most remarkable moments in our interviews came with the actor Gary Cole, who portrayed Office Space boss Bill Lumberg. Since he is a great actor, he often answered our questions within character, his voice reflecting the passivity of Lumberg or the spunk of one of his other famous roles, Bob Russell, the vice president on the West Wing. During one of these moments when his voice sounded like Vice President Bob Russell, we asked what the character's pitfall was. Without a second of hesitation, he said, "I don't know that I see an Achilles heel or any weakness." Then Cole came out of character, and a second later said, "Well, if they have a weakness, it's that they don't recognize that they have any weakness. They don't acknowledge them. Humility isn't high on their chart." Cole added, "Lumberg and Russell have blinders on, and they can only go forward. They have no reverse gear. They have no reflective genes in their body." This moment captures the problem. When in character, when viewing the world through the eyes of someone at stage 3, Cole reported no mistakes, no major weaknesses. The moment he took on the language system of stage 4, which is how Cole speaks when he's talking about his own life, the pitfalls of his character were as obvious as Bill Lumberg's trademark coffee mug. Stage 3 cannot see the effects of its behavior. Just as without a mirror, you can't see your own eyeballs. As the second part of the epiphany was drawing to a close, Tobias saw the real problem with stage 3. It cannot be fixed. It can only be abandoned. Saying, "I will fix this situation," is another form of stage 3. Like saying, "I'm great because I see myself the way others see me, and I am working on my legacy." Trying to do this merely creates new blind spots and repeats the stage 3 cycle. Furthermore, the costs of stage 3 become increasingly clear. People are, in fact, accomplishing the opposite of what they want. Tobias said, "I was fighting for dignity and respect for federal employees." And yet his badass behavior wasn't in line with these values at all. He was removing dignity and respect from the system, not adding them. Epiphany Part 3. What's the real goal? The first two parts of the epiphany allow the person to ask a question. What am I really trying to accomplish? Other versions of the question we heard were, what's the point of all this? And how do we know if we're successful? In the midst of this epiphany, people we interviewed had many different goals that are surprisingly similar. David Kelly, the founder and CEO of IDEO, whom we'll get to know in the next chapter, said, "The goal is to hang with friends and do things greater than any one of us could do alone." George Zimmer, the CEO of Men's Warehouse, made famous for his television commercials saying, "I guarantee it," told us, "The goal of business is that we have fun and that we are dead serious about it. It's even in our corporate bylaws." All of these goals boil down to wanting to make an impact on a large group of people. At this stage of the epiphany, physicians remember that they went to medical school to help people, lawyers that they studied law to protect people's rights, professors became professors to do for others what someone had done for them, kindle a love of learning. In a sense, this third phase of the Epiphany brings people back to a simpler time in their lives. They're moving not back, but forward, integrating and expanding their original goal with what they've learned while moving through stage three. As the person sees into her blind spots, she realizes that the ego hit of accomplishment is not the same as success itself. Her attention shifts to what is really important to her, and almost always the goal is tribal. David Kelly of IDEO said his goal became hanging out with great people and creating stuff that makes a difference. George Zimmer, CEO of Men's Warehouse, said, "We need to keep thinking about the people in our stores and how to make their lives better." Frank Jordan, the former mayor of San Francisco, whom we met in Chapter 4, is one of the most self-effacing people we met. He now works as special assistant to the president of the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. Gordon Moore is the co-founder of Intel and founder of the foundation. Jordan said about Moore, "So many people are saying me, 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 and Moore is so unassuming, so humble. He says, we don't need publicity. We're not looking for publicity. We're looking for projects to fund. It's so different from the people I knew in politics." Jordan revealed himself as someone who had the epiphany in saying this about his boss. People still at stage three might have said, "It's great to work with someone who can keep up with me." As the seesaw tilts toward stage four, the person's language and behavior shifts away from I and dyadic relationships toward we and networked systems of people. This is the part of the epiphany that is the most remarkable to us. Its work is automatic. Tobias said, "It was so obvious, I couldn't believe I didn't see it before. The more the group succeeds, the more I succeed." As transformational expert Werner Erhard told us, "Let it use you. Don't try to use it." One of the most moving descriptions of this larger goal came from actor Gary Cole, this time talking about his life, not about his roles. Cole has a daughter with autism, and when he and his wife first heard the diagnosis, they went in search of a tribe to help them. As they talked with parents, medical experts, and people with autism, they became tribal authorities on the subject, using Cole's celebrity to increase awareness and provide support to other families. When we asked him what drove this effort, he answered as if he were saying what everyone knows. If you had to categorize any purpose in the world, it would be to help someone. What is the reason anyone is here? You can point to having an experience, and then someone down the road is in trouble, and they're going through what you survived, and you stick your hand out. If you had to shortly define humanity, that would be it. Once Cole saw the goal, having an impact on people, his behavior was automatic, like getting out of bed in the morning. He was used by it, in Earhart's words. Also notice that his language is not focused on I, me, or my. He is speaking for a tribe of people. Ironically, his epiphany is exactly what the characters he plays, such as Bill Lumberg, need to experience to move to We're Great. They would have to see the goal as clearly as the actor who brought them to life. First, though, they would have to see the effect of their behavior and that they cannot succeed alone. With the goal in place, Tobias's actions fell in line with stage four. He no longer tried to beat up the local union presidents to get their compliance. His staff's complaint that "you haven't changed one bit" vanished as he spoke with people in the union and in government to look for common ground. He noticed that everyone around him valued dignity and respect, and he began talking about a union that would bring those values to life for everyone in the federal system. Now speaking for thousands of people, not just for himself, Tobias's words carried the weight of a tribal leader. He met with local union presidents and said, "It's not enough to be reactive, to sit behind your desk and wait for management to screw up, which they will, and beat the shit out of them. You have to be more than an insurance policy. You have to represent the 95% who never use any union services." Notice that Tobias now spoke for the people and his language dropped the stage 3 focus on I. He also found that when he spoke for the tribe, his words carried real weight. Ironically, by dropping the focus on himself, he became stronger. Note that people don't lose ambition, drive, or work ethic by moving to stage 4. After the epiphany, Tobias had more personal power, not less. Don Beck, author of Spiral Dynamics, told us, "The old system, stage 3, doesn't disappear. The new system, stage 4, transcends and subsumes it." In the same way that a glass of water is much more than the individual H2O molecules that make it up, nothing is lost when people move to the next stage. Stage 4 takes everything that works about stage 3 and reorganizes it so that the person becomes more powerful. From our experience, people going through the epiphany found that fact reassuring, giving them a stronger vision for what was to come. Ironically, if people attempt to force the epiphany in order to become stronger, it doesn't work. They have to see and feel and know and believe that stage 3 will not get them to where they want to go. Epiphany Part 4. How does a tribal leader use power? Niccolo Machiavelli's life would make a great storyline for any daytime soap opera. He was expelled from his political office when the Medici family came to rule in Florence, Italy in 1494. Desperate to return to politics, he wrote a book many of us should have read in high school and didn't, The Prince. As the Cliff Notes made clear to us, the authors of this book, when we were in college, we were too busy living the stage 3 lifestyle to read the actual book, Machiavelli advocated cruelty and deception as the means to winning and keeping power. He is best known for his single admonition, "It is better to be feared than loved." As often happens in history, public perception had more weight than the truth. Alone but with a cunning mind, he wrote The Prince as a treatise on power. Many assume that his intent was to prove his value as a mafia-style consigliere, like the Robert Duvall character in the Godfather movies. Although historians disagree on exactly how much the book represents his thinking, one thing is certain. The Prince cemented the author's reputation as a cunning and treacherous political strategist. The public reaction against the book was so sharp that Machiavelli never gained the political office he sought, and he died alone in 1527. 75 years later, Shakespeare wrote about a Machiavelli in Richard III, essentially meaning a son of a bitch. His reputation is much the same today, someone who advocated any means necessary to win. Why, then, does Stephen Sample, president of the University of Southern California, think so highly of Machiavelli? Sample, whose doctorate is in engineering, is speaking with more authority than a layperson. He has studied Machiavelli for years, both as a subject he teaches in a leadership course with leadership guru Warren Bennis, and as a tool for leading one of the world's largest universities. His ideas about leadership, including his positive read on The Prince, became the subject of his book, The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership. Sample's view of Machiavelli is that, in the hands of a wise person, the techniques he advocated are critical to keeping the state, we would say the tribe, strong by repelling enemies from without and from within. Here's one quote from The Prince. "Well-committed atrocities are committed once so one may establish himself. Poorly committed atrocities are done at first sparingly, then more and more. Therefore, one taking a state must commit all the atrocities at the beginning." This quote reminds us of Jack Welch's early days at the helm of General Electric, when he fired so many people he was nicknamed Neutron Jack, but the company emerged stronger and healthier because of his actions. The critical question to ask about atrocities, or in a business context, tough decisions, is in service of what? We've met hundreds of managers who put this passage from The Prince into service for their own promotion, the Stage 3 system. They fired the people who threatened their power, destroyed Stage 4 cultures that preached a different way of operating, and purged their departments of anyone who didn't seem loyal to them. Steve Sample admits that Machiavelli's techniques, in the hands of someone out for personal gain, can be disastrous. We've seen companies destroyed by people at Stage 3, using the prince as their Bible. Steve Sample sees a higher purpose in Machiavelli's techniques because he's looking from the other side of the epiphany, from the perspective of Stage 4. As evidence of his tribal leader status, Sample has arguably led the most impressive academic turnaround in the history of American higher education, raising USC from a jock school to an institution where incoming test scores are among the highest in the nation, all in 10 years. In the process, he has made many tough decisions, most of which net out to the institution coming first. He leads from a clear set of values, has taken on some large egos in the university, and, although respected, has made his share of enemies. Talking about university governance, Sample told us, you can get deans, provosts, even presidents, who are all about themselves and not the institution as a whole, and they lead to a rotting, a corrupting of the institution. How does he identify the people who are out for themselves? He told us, you have to listen to all the feedback, including complaints. You learn to smell it out. Sample's view that Stage 3 leads to institutional decay shows that he sees Stage 3 for what it is, blinding the person and damaging the tribe. Sample's view of Machiavelli is that, in service of the institution, the prince is filled with principles that help ground the leader in a good understanding of human nature. It never occurs to this university president that people might use the techniques in service of their own egos, hence his positive view of the ancient scholar. That's not to say that Sample has a naive view of people. Like most tribal leaders, Sample does see value in individual Stage 3 performers. In the university setting, such individuals can bring success to the institution by winning grants and awards, even Nobel Prizes. Sample told us, the same is true in companies, reflecting on service on 14 corporate boards. But Sample fumes over specific faculty, mostly in the arts, who have been nurtured by the university for years, and as soon as they make it big, he said, it's like they're owned by the cosmos, and have always been owned by the cosmos. And when asked about USC, they'll say, isn't that in Los Angeles? I remember being on the campus a time or two. As is true with people who have gone through the epiphany, Sample's anger is based not on personal offense, but on a perceived act of disloyalty toward the tribes he leads. We met a tribal leader in medicine, Dr. Mark Rummins of the Billings Clinic in Montana, who has taken Sample's advice and put atrocities into a Stage 4 context. His wall has a plaque visible from the chairs in his administrative office, which reads, "The first clean kill awakens the whole herd." This sign is stunning to people who know him as a man with a soft voice and a warm demeanor, and as a person famous for his self-deprecating humor. His tone and manners convey a tribal leader's set of concerns, a love for people, empathy for their problems, and putting the institution before ego. This tribal leader makes it clear that violating rules has consequences and that he will enforce them. And we've seen him follow the adage on his wall with such unwavering conviction and resolution that it has shocked people around him. Sample has done the same, as have hundreds of other tribal leaders we've met. Glenn Esnard, a tribal leader whom we'll meet in a later chapter, told us, you have to publicly execute people who disobey the rules. Otherwise, everyone thinks you don't mean what you say, and then there's no leadership, only bullshit. What Machiavelli refers to as atrocities, Sample calls decisions you have to make for the good of the institution. Esnard, raised in the wild, wild west of Stage 3 commercial real estate, calls it doing the work of the sheriff. But notice he's on the side of tribal values not out for his own advancement. After the epiphany, old rules are repurposed for the advancement of the tribe. Sample argues that great leaders, from time to time, need to use shocking methods to strengthen the tribe. In his book, The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership, and in his conversations with us, he repeats a story which he admits may be apocryphal, that after World War II, Douglas MacArthur ordered the execution of many American soldiers who had raped Japanese women. The general went so far to invite Japanese leaders to attend the event. Sample told us it was incomprehensible to them that an invading leader would execute his own soldiers for doing what soldiers had always done. The action had the effect of strengthening the tribe of American soldiers and demonstrating the Army's values to Japanese leaders. While Steve Sample, Mark Rummins, Glenn Esnard, and Bob Tobias haven't executed anyone, literally, each has demonstrated that tribal leaders don't back down from difficult decisions. Their approach isn't touchy-feely and they aren't pushovers. Their focus, however, is purely on the tribe. By drawing on the tribe's convictions and values, they became more powerful than they were at stage three. End of the epiphany. I am because we are. Once the three phases of the epiphany have done their work, a leader's entire language system realigns. She still has an ego, but it's focused on the tribe, not on herself. I language is out, and we language is in. Dyads are becoming replaced by triads, as we'll examine in a later chapter. Instead of speaking for herself and assuming that others will see the logic of her point of view, she begins to listen, to learn about the tribe, and to speak for it. As all this happens, a subtle but rapid change begins. She accrues respect, loyalty, followers, and an expectation of great things. While amassing this following, she doesn't think it has anything to do with her. Several of the tribal leaders we interviewed, including Gordon Binder, first turned us down, saying that they hadn't done anything. Binder went further. He said, "I just got out of the way and let the managers at Amgen do the right thing." We finally persuaded him to talk by pointing out that, at a minimum, he didn't stop the effort. In fact, he was an active player, but his focus on we gives the credit to others. Tobias had spent years working collaboratively with the Internal Revenue Service, rather than only filing grievances or unfair labor practice charges. His reputation as a collaborator spread throughout the government, including to then-Senator Al Gore. With a change in administration in 1992 and the election of Clinton and Gore, there was an opportunity to change the labor-management relationships in the federal government. Looking back, Tobias said, "The whole idea for why we have a union changed. In 1992, I realized I could work with Clinton, which is ironic for a man who got started suing a president." He met with Gore, then vice president and chair of Clinton's Reinventing Government program. Tobias said, "The argument was compelling. You can't change the workplace that's 80% organized without dealing with the organization unions." Tobias worked with the other federal sector unions to send the vice president a proposal that he, together with the other union leaders, helped to implement as an executive order, stating that the government would work collaboratively with the unions. Tobias said, "Then it wasn't me speaking. It was the federal labor movement and the executive branch managers, including the President of the United States." Tobias finally found leverage with union leaders who were still using the badass model. Shortly after interviewing several people who had gone through this epiphany, we talked with Don Beck, who, after writing Spiral Dynamics, spent years in Africa. He said, after hearing about the three stages of the epiphany, "There's a word in the Bantu languages that Archbishop Desmond Tutu has used to help bring the entire country of South Africa together. Ubuntu, meaning, today I share with you because tomorrow you share with me." The word can also be translated, I am, because we are. The essence of tribal leadership is building the we, and as a person does this, his influence, respect, and power increase. The leap of faith. Tobias describes his move through the phases of the Epiphany as a journey in which he was pulled rather than did the pulling, but he reflected that one element is required, a leap of faith. He said, I was committed to a system I couldn't picture. Somehow it just had to be better, and the allure of what I thought might be possible was enough to keep me moving. When he finally stepped down from the National Treasury Employees Union after 31 years, the last 16 as its president, it had grown from 20,000 people, mostly IRS employees, to 155,000, representing employees in 26 different federal agencies. As is common with tribal leaders, Tobias leveraged his experience and expertise, including the three phases of the Epiphany, to grow into the final stage of leadership, which we call a Stage 5 Tribal Elder. We'll meet up with him again in a later chapter. After meeting many people like Tobias, we met to summarize what we were learning. A metaphor popped into our discussion that we've used ever since. It captures the courage required to take the leap of faith into tribal leadership. Here it is. In school, when someone goes up a grade, say from third to fourth, the new grade isn't fun. There isn't as much art or painting. The old teacher is gone, as is our rapport with her. To make it worse, we see her at recess, surrounded by children who aren't us, and it just feels unfair. A few months later, going back to the old grade seems unimaginably simple. We can barely believe we were challenged by the topics of the third grade, now that we're on to tougher math and harder reading. The games seem juvenile and silly. When we're ready to leave the fourth grade, we have the same feelings as we did a year before. Where this metaphor breaks down is that we don't ever have to leave stage three, so we get to choose to stay where it's comfortable, or to challenge ourselves and go for excellence. Whether to stay with stage three or advance to stage four is the single most important question for individuals and corporations around the world. As Tobias recounted the story of his epiphany, we asked what advice he would give to people still in the wild, wild west aspect of stage three. His answer summarized our research, and it was in line with that of other experts we interviewed. He said, I would ask what their goal is. If it's to win, keep on doing it. If it's to make a larger impact, how do you create relationships to get what it is you want them to do? You can't do it by yourself. You have to work with others. Werner Erhard told us that transformation begins with accepting things exactly as they are and exactly as they are not. When people see the effects of their behavior, they can make a decision, stay in stage three, or engage the epiphany. The choice is up to each person.